Om, om. All right. Good. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahavirjan Karava Vahai, Tejasvinavadhi Tamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Very good. Welcome back. Before we begin our study of chapter 10, I have an important bit of information to share with you. Some of you heard from me on Tuesday in class that my guru, Pujya Swami Dayananda, whom many of you know quite well, has been in the hospital, and I have some updated information. He's been in the hospital for 2 weeks. He went into the hospital because of pneumonia. Apparently there was a complication of the pneumonia that created the necessity for an operation to remove a portion of one of his lungs. The good news is that he is off the ventilator and he's expected to recover. And I think that's quite amazing given his 83 years and given his overall condition, which is quite bad. The fact that he's recovering is could be thought of as a miracle. So it's quite good news, although I'm sure the situation has been and perhaps remains quite serious. For that reason, it would be really appropriate for us to offer a prayer for his full recovery. Traditionally, we'll recite the Mahamrityunjaya mantra. We'll do so today. We'll chant 11 times. The first time, you can listen and repeat. The next 10 times, we'll chant together, and we'll conclude with just a moment of silence, and then we'll continue our class. Listen and repeat the first time, please. Om Triambakam Yajamahe, Om Triambakam Yajamahe, Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam, Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam, Urvarukamiva Bandhanan, Urvarukamiva Bandha, Mrityor Mukshiha Mamratahata, Mrityor Mukshiha Mamratahata. Together. Om Triambakam Yajamahe, Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam, Urvarukamiva Bandhanan, Mrityor Mukshiha Mamratahata. Om Triambakam Yajamahe, Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam, Urvarukamiva Bandhanan, Mrityor Mukshiha Mamratahata. Om Triambakam Yajamahe, Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam, Urvarukamiva Bandhanan, Mrityor Mukshiya Mamratahata. Om Triambakam Yajamahe, Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam, Urvarukamiva Bandhanan, Mrityor Mukshiya Mamratahata. Om Triambakam Yajamahe, Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam, Urvarukamiva Bandhanan, Mrityor Mukshiya Mamratahata. Om Triambakam Yajamahe, Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam, Urvarukamiva Bandhanan, Mrityor Mukshiya Mamratahata. Om Triambakam Yajamahe, Sugandhim Pushtivardhanam, Urvarukamiva Bandhanan, Mrityor
Yajamahe. 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 Yajamahe.
Sugandham Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshihamamratahata Om Triambakam Yajamahe Sugandham Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshihamamratahata Om Triambakam Yajamahe Sugandham Pushtivardhanam Urvarukamiva Bandhanan Mrityor Mukshihamamratahata. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Very good, thank you. So let us return to our Bhagavad Gita. We'll begin our recitation with verse 19, where Arjuna's leading question comes. I'm looking in the wrong place. I've got the right slide up. I've got the wrong page in front of me. I think it's verse 12. Yes, verse 12. Where Arjuna's question begins, repeat after me. Arjuna vacha, Arjuna vacha, param brahma param dhamma, param brahma param, pavitram paramam bhavan, pavitram Purusham Shashvatam Divyam Purusham Shashvatam Adi Devam Ajam Vibhum Adi Devam Ajam Ahustva Mrishayas Sarve Ahustva Mrishayas Devarshir Naradas Tata Devarshir Naradas Asato Devalo Vyasaha Asato Devalo Swayam chaiva pravishime, swayam chaiva pravish, sarvam etad hritam manye, sarvam etad hritam, yanmam varasi keshava, yanmam varasi, nahite bhagavan vyaktam, nahite bhagavan, vidur devana danavaha, vidur devana, Swayam hevatmanatmanam, swayam hevatmanat, vetatvam purushottama, vetatvam, bhuta bhavana bhutesha, bhuta bhavana, deva deva jagatpate, deva deva jagat, vaktum harhasya sheshena, vaktum harhasya se, Divya hyatma vibhutayaha, divya hyatma vibhut, yabhir vibhuti bhir lokan, yabhir vibhuti bhir, imams twam prapyatishtasi, imams twam prapyatish, katam vidyamaham yogins, aham vidyamaham yogins, Twam sada pari chintayan, twam sada pari Keshu keshu cha bhaveshu, keshu keshu cha bhav Chintyosi bhagavan maya, chintyosi bhagavan Vistare natmano yogam, vistare natmano Vibhutim cha janardana, vibhutim cha janardana Bhuyah kataya triptirhi, bhuyah kataya triptirhi. Shrinvanto nasti me mrutam, shrinvanto nasti me. Shri Bhagavanu vacha, Shri Bhagavanu vacha, hanta te kata yashyami, hanta te kata. Sorry. Hanta te kata yashyami, hanta te Divya hyatma vibhutayaha, divya hyatma vibhutayaha, pradhanyatah kuru shreshtha, pradhanyatah kuru shreshtha, nasyanto vistarasya me, nasyanto vistaras, ahamatma gurakesha, ahamatma sarvabhutashaya sthitaha, sarvabhushastayasti aham adishcha madhyam cha aham adishcha mad bhutanam hanta heva cha bhutanam hanta heva cha. Very good. So we saw in our last class, we saw Arjuna's question about all, what are Sri Krishna's vibhutis? What are the Lord's vibhuti? Vibhuti here meaning glory, the glories of God. And actually I received a question. The title of the chapter is actually Vibhuti Yoga. And here yoga, as you know, doesn't mean a spiritual practice. There's no spiritual, you don't practice vibhuti. So yoga, as you know, means a chapter title. When it comes in the title of the Bhagavad Gita chapters, the word yoga means chapter title. So Vibhuti Yoga is a chapter entitled Vibhuti. Yoga has many meanings, so and this is a meaning in this context. And the question came is that the word Vibhuti is also used very commonly to refer to the sacred ash commonly applied to one's forehead. And the question is, what is the relationship between the two? And it happens that in Sanskrit, as in all languages, words have many meanings. Like the word yoga can actually mean the title of a chapter, which is not what you'd expect. But in an expression like Vibhuti Yoga, the word yoga takes on that meaning. In the same way, the word Vibhuti has many meanings. In fact, I was curious. I wanted to check. Sometimes words will come into sometimes Sanskrit words will come into Tamil with a very different meaning than they have in Sanskrit. And I wanted to find out if that was true of the word Vibhuti. So a good example, by the way, I don't know Tamil, so this was told to me by my guru, that the word samsara comes into Tamil as samsaram, which is used to refer to your wife. I didn't know that. Just a word of warning that languages can import words and put their own twist on those words. So that happens. So I wanted to find out in Sanskrit if the word vibhuti extended to sacred ash. So I pulled out a dictionary, and no, not surprisingly, there were 9 or 10 definitions. The first, of course, were the definitions that we're using, you know, the glory, might, grandeur, power, words like that. But it turns out that one of the last definitions, indeed, was sacred ash made from burnt cow dung, which is how it's traditionally prepared. So it turns out that it does indeed, in Sanskrit, it is indeed used to refer to the sacred ash applied to one's forehead, the same ash that's up here at our altar. And if we want to find out what is the connection between a word that means glory, I guess it's a symbol of Lord Shiva's glory, and ash in particular, since Lord Shiva possesses that third eye, which is capable of reducing demons to ash, as he did Kamadeva. So that ash, then, that's associated with Lord Shiva, is symbolic of his glory, of Lord Shiva's glory. And perhaps that's the reason that Vibhuti is also used for that sacred ash. So in the context of this chapter, of course, it does not refer to the sacred ash at all. It refers exclusively to God's power, God's glory. And Arjuna's question, which we saw in the last class, was a question about the vibhutis for the sake of meditation. And this is really the key to understanding this section of the chapter. Arjuna already understands who and what is Ishvara based on the teachings in chapter 7 and 9. So Arjuna has no lack of understanding. Arjuna understands Ishvara as the nimitta and upadana karana, as the source of the material because of which the universe exists, upadana karana, and the source of the intelligence, the laws of nature because of which the universe exists, that nimitta karana. And Arjuna also understands that the Lord has a para and an apara aspect, a transcendent and an immanent aspect. The immanent aspect is that upadana and nimitta karana, that presence in the universe, and there's also a para aspect, a transcendent aspect that's beyond the mind, beyond imagination. Arjuna understands all this, but he asks further in this chapter. He asks specifically, in what forms are you to be meditated on? And that really forms the bulk of this chapter, is about the forms in which we can meditate on Ishvara. I mean, how about a trick question? How would you meditate on that transcendent aspect of Ishvara? Now remember, the transcendent aspect of Ishvara, by our dream metaphor, meant the dreamer who's laying down in his or her bed. Do the dream characters have any concept whatsoever about the dreamer laying down in bed? No concept whatsoever. From the standpoint of the dream characters, the dreamer is inconceivable. So therefore, when Arjuna asks earlier, how are you to be meditated on, he's not referring to the transcendent aspect. So our discussion here is not about Parabrahma, the absolute reality because of which everything exists. That absolute reality has no qualities, has no characteristics. We use the word nirguna. How can you meditate on something which is formless and free from qualities? You can't. You can, but in some obscure ways, which is not our subject matter right now. So, therefore, this discussion that we're about to return to is about Ishvara's immanent nature, the apara nature. The technical word in Vedanta is saguna brahma. And saguna brahma refers to Ishvara's immanent presence in the world as the source of the material because of which the world exists, upadana karana, and a source of the intelligence, the laws of nature because of which the world exists, nimitta karana. And in response to Arjuna's question, Sri Krishna answered, and we saw only the first verse of his answer in the last class, where he said, Hanta, O dear one, te katayashyami, I will tell you. I will tell you, divya atma vibhutayaha, I will tell you my divine glories. Arjuna asked, if you just remember this, Arjuna asked for, please tell me elaborately, extensively, please tell me all of your glories. And Sri Krishna says, I can't do that. Why not? Pradhanyata kurushvareshta. O Arjuna, I will only tell you the main qualities, the main vibhutis, pradhanyataha. Why? Na asti antaha vistarasya me. There is no end or limit to my glory, to my grandeur, to my powers. So Sri Krishna says, I will tell you the main powers for the sake of meditation. Do you need a list of thousands and thousands and thousands of aspects of Ishvara for the sake of meditation? No. What we do receive is many dozens. The typical, we're going to see maybe about 20 verses or so, and there's probably an average of 4 qualities per verse. So we might see as many as 100 qualities, which is more than enough. So with that introduction, let's turn to the beginning and see How does Sri Krishna describe these main attributes, qualities, powers, glories, vibhutis? How does he describe them? And that description begins with verse 20. Aham atma guda kesha, aham atma guda sarva bhutashaya sthitaha, sarva bhutashaya aham adishcha madhyam cha, aham adishcha madhyam bhutanam hanta heva cha, bhutanam hanta heva. So he begins by addressing Arjuna as guda kesha. I think this is the only place in the Bhagavad Gita where he's addressed with that name. A little bit odd. Sri Shankara gives two explanations. The obvious explanation, guda means thick. So guda kesha, one who has thick hair, means one who is young and virile and not losing their hair like me. So that's the idea. So guda kesha. Shankara's commentary actually gives an alternate. He always likes to do that, give you alternate interpretations. Gudaka isha. Gudaka here means sleep. Isha, lord, or master. The one who has mastered his sleep, which means the one who can go without sleep. Gudaka isha. To me, that's a bit of a stretch. You have a nice way of showing that in India. There's a straightforward explanation, guda kesha, the one with thick hair, but the other one is a stretch, like touching your nose like this. It's a stretch. You can do it. So gudaka isha, the one who has mastered sleep, is a fine explanation, but it looks like a stretch. It doesn't make much difference. So, O Arjuna, Sri Krishna begins, aham atma, I am the self, sarva bhutashaya stitaha, the self who is stitaha, who is placed, who abides, ashaya, in the midst, who abides within, sarva bhuta, all creatures. I am the self who abides in all creatures. Now, that's extremely profound. And it turns out that's not really one of the forms to... Actually, let me share with you Shankara's commentary on that. There's something... It surprised me when I saw this commentary. Shankara says, antar hridi stitaha, of course, the one who is stitaha abiding, antar hridi, inside, in the heart. And abiding how? Pratyagatma, as the inner self. Nityam dhyayaha, and this is to be always meditated on. But you can only meditate on what you know. You can't meditate on something you don't know. One who truly knows pratyagatma, one who truly knows Ishvara's presence within, one who truly knows is enlightened. Does that mean you have to be enlightened in order to meditate? Well, in order to meditate on God's presence in your heart as a reality because of which you exist as a conscious being, in order to meditate on that very clearly, presumably you should be meditated on, you should be enlightened, sorry. But what Arjuna says here is, tat ashaktena, he says, suppose you're not able to meditate on that presence of God within as consciousness, tada shaktena. Suppose you're not able to, for whatever reason, he says, antreshu bhaveshu chintyaha aham. He says, in that case, you can meditate on me in all of the following ways, which means aham adihicha, etc., etc. So, in other words, Shankara here is putting this first description aside as being special. The first, you know, we're going to see a long list of expressions where Sri Krishna says, I am this, I am that, I am this, I am that. But he begins by saying, I am Atma, Sarva-bhutatma. I am the self of all beings. So Shankara points out, this expression is special. This expression really shows true self-knowledge, wisdom, enlightenment. So then we could say then that the forms, Arjuna asks, what are the forms in which you are to be meditated on? We could say that this is not one of the forms. This is pure knowledge. So we could say then the forms in which Sri Krishna is to be meditated on begins with the next part, the next line, which is Aham Adihi Madhyam and Antaha Bhutanam. Bhutanam, for all creatures, for all that exists. Aham, I am the Adi, the beginning. I am the Madhyam, the middle, and I am the Antaha, the end. Now, beginning, middle, and end doesn't mean like if you have a piece of string which has a beginning, middle, and end. That's not the point. It's a metaphor. Most of you get the metaphor very quickly. Adi refers to creator, srishti karta. Madhyam refers to the sustainer, sthiti karta. And anta, end, refers to the upasamhara karta, the one into whom the world returns at the end of time. So this is the first of the ways in which Ishvara is to be meditated on. The one from whom the universe arises, the one by whom the universe is sustained, the one unto whom the universe returns at the end of time. This is the first of many, and it's meant for meditation. Meditation can be in a very concrete way. To reflect with a quiet, contemplative mind, to reflect on the fact that this universe has a source. That source must be capable of providing the material for this entire cosmos and the intelligence of this entire cosmos. There is that source. Also, this universe continues to exist right now. So to reflect with a quiet mind that the existence of this universe right now is due to the immediate presence of Ishvara as the substance and as the laws of nature. And finally, at the end of time, when the universe undergoes dissolution, the universe returns to that source to reflect upon that with a contemplative mind is what is intended by this particular verse. Okay, we will move on. And many of these verses we're going to go a little bit more quickly. There's not a lot of new teachings. In fact, chapter 7 and 9 taken together, it's so complete. There's nothing new to be taught here. So therefore, what is being described are these many, many forms in which God is to be meditated on. And we'll probably go more quickly through some of these verses. All right. Aditya namaham Vishnur, Aditya namaham Jyotisham Raviramshuman, Jyotisham Raviramshum Marichir Marutam Hasmi, Marichir Marutam Nakshatra namaham Shashi, Nakshatra namaham Shashi. Good. Adityanam aham Vishnuhu. And this is the language that's going to be used for many verses. Adityanam, among the Adityas. Now, Aditya here refers to a class of deities, which are known collectively as Aditya. And there happened to be a group of 12 of them. And this is really the subject matter of the Puranas. Here we're studying actually a portion of the Mahabharata, so it's not uncommon for the Mahabharata to quote from the Puranas. So in the Puranic mythology, they'll speak of a group of 12 deities called Adityas. And the one of the Adityas, most, excuse me, many of the Adityas are actually fairly obscure deities. They're not well-known, powerful, important deities. But one of those deities is Vishnu. And Vishnu, in the tradition, is an extraordinarily important aspect of, based on prior verse, Madhyam, the one who sustains the cosmos. So Vishnu is a name for that one who sustains the cosmos. The word Vishnu also means the one who pervades the cosmos. That all-pervasive sustainer of the cosmos. And in mythology, Vishnu is one of the most important deities. If you go through all the Puranas, perhaps there are more stories about Vishnu than any other deity. So among these 12 Adityas, Vishnu is the most important. Now, to us in modern times, this may not be a very powerful metaphor, because most of us don't spend lots of time studying Puranic mythology, and which are the 12 Adityas, etc., may not be that significant to us. But here we are reading a very ancient text, so we have to put it, you know, bear that in mind. If we lived in ancient times, this would be very powerful. If I think in modern times, if you had to rewrite this, you'd have to change everything. You have to use modern metaphors. So modern, and I'm being a little bit silly now, but just to suggest a modern metaphor is Sri Krishna is saying, I'm the best of the best. And that's kind of the format that's going to go on through all of these, through many of the next verses. So he says, of the Adityas, I am the best. I am Vishnu. So suppose we were to express that in not using ancient mythology, but some modern expressions. Up-to-date expressions. And how about this one? Again, this is just silly. Among scientists, I am Einstein. This would be the sense. Among all scientists, I am Einstein. So if this text were written in modern terms, that could indeed be an expression. And that's the nature of this. Let's just take this first line just to understand the style of the poetry right now. To understand, if you allow me, since I gave a scientific metaphor, let me give you a little metaphor from science. One of the ways that science proceeds is to examine extremes of nature. Examine extremes of nature would mean to examine, how about to examine what happens when something is extremely cold, near absolute zero, or to examine what happens when something is extremely hot, at many thousands or even millions of degrees. Science proceeds, to a large extent, by looking at the extremes. And it turns out, by looking at extremes, you learn so much. How about human nature? You learn a lot about human nature by looking at extremes. You can look at the extremes of hate and malice by recalling the 19 hijackers who brought down the planes on 9/11. We can look at the extreme of compassion by looking at, say, the Dalai Lama, who is trying to God knows how, trying to reason with the Chinese. You have to be so patient, I suppose. Think of what he's been trying to do for decades, to work with the Chinese to come to some amicable solution and to preserve that Tibetan culture and religion. And he has done so. He has steadfastly refused any kind of forceful response. So this incredibly compassionate response, even though he personally and so many of his people have been subject to terrible circumstances as a result of Chinese invasion of Tibet. Anyway, by looking at the extremes of the world, scientists learn about the world. By looking at the extremes of human nature, we learn about human nature. Here, by looking at extremes of the cosmos, both the physical world and the subtle world. We have to include all these deities like the Adityas. Scientists can't study these 12 Adityas, so it's part of a subtle world. So by examining the extremes of the physical and subtle worlds, we can learn so much about Ishvara. And that's really, really what's being taught here. So Adityanam, among these 12 celestial beings called Adityas, Aham Vishnuhu, I am the best, I am the most prominent, the most powerful, I am Vishnu. And it continues, Jyotisham, among light, Jyoti means light, among various sources of light, well, that's easy. What is the most powerful source of light? Ravihi, the sun, Amshuman, with all of its Amshus, all of its rays. So that shining sun is the most glorious of all sources of light. In ancient times, you know, what sources of light did they have? They had little diyas and lamps and candles, etc. So compared to all of that, the sun is by far the most glorious, the most brightly shining. So among all these sources of light, I am Ravi, I am Amshumam, I am the shining sun. Marichihi Marutam Asmi. Among the Maruts. And here we got the same problem. There are 12 Adityas, of which we know very little. There are 49 Maruts, of which we know even less. Unless we were back in that ancient culture, this is not terribly relevant to us, but the scripture comes from that ancient culture. What can we do? So we understand. So among these 49 Maruts, I am Marichi, the prominent one, the best of them, whose name was Marichi. And Nakshatranam, Nakshatra means star, but it also means anything that's shining up there in the night sky. So when you look up into the night sky, you see many stars. You also see a few planets, right? The stars are blinking. The planets really don't blink or flicker like that. But they're all pretty dim. But there's one thing you see up there in the night sky that is not dim at all, and that is a shining moon. So that Shashi, the moon, among all the nakshatras, among all the stars, among all the lights in the sky, the Shashi, the moon, is the foremost. I like this word Shashi. I may have mentioned this before. Shasha is rabbit. Shashin, or Shashi, is one who has a rabbit. That's the name for the moon. Shashi, the one who has a rabbit. And the reason for that, you may have heard me explain, we in Western culture, we talk about seeing the dark areas of the moon. In Western culture, we speak of the man in the moon. In ancient India, they didn't see a man. They saw a rabbit. So therefore, the moon, in fact, a very clear name, one of the many names for moon is Shashanka. You've heard Shashank, perhaps. That's a common Hindi name. The one who's Anka, the one that is marked with a Shasha, with the moon. So here, Shashi, the moon. Now, before we move on, this is meant for meditation. This stuff is not meant, in a way, this stuff is not meant to be studied. We're studying it now. But it's not meant to be studied. It's meant to be meditated on. How to meditate on? Well, the Maruts and Adityas, maybe we can't meditate on. It's a little bit obscure for us. But to meditate on the sun, what is Gayatri meditation about after all? Gayatri mantra is addressed to sun. So to recite Gayatri mantra and to meditate on tat bhargaha, that light, tat varenyam bhargaha, that sacred light, devasya savituhu, of God in the form of sun, to meditate on that sacred light of God in the form of sun, is exactly what is being prescribed here by Sri Krishna. That the sun is a superb form upon which to meditate upon God. Just to make this a little bit more clear, with a counter example. So if we said meditate on extremes, not the middle things, how about meditate on God in a form of 100-watt light bulb? 100-watt light bulb is a very ordinary thing. It certainly is in the middle of human experience, and it would be considered extremely inappropriate for the sake of meditating on God. It's not the extreme. So you go to the extreme form, the shining sun, or in a night sky, you go to that which shines most brightly, that beautiful moon. So these objects become very suitable for meditation upon Ishvara. All right. Vedanham samavedosmi, Vedanham samavedanam asmi vasavaha, Devanam asmi vas indriyanam manaschasmi, Indriyanam manasch bhutanam asmi chetana, Bhutanam asmi chetana. Vedanam, among the Vedas, among our four Vedas, Rig, Yajur, Sama, Atharva. So among the four Vedas, Sama Vedaha Asmi. I'm the Sama Veda. That the extreme among the Vedas. In what sense is the Sama Veda the extreme among the Vedas? The Sama Veda is the only Veda that is sung rather than chanted. Most of our Vedas, all other Vedic passages are chanted using these three notes. You know, aham, om sahana vavatu, sahanao bhunaktu, etc. You only get three notes. There's a middle note, there's a lower note, there's a higher note. Only in the Sama Veda do you have five or even seven notes on which it is sung, not chanted. So that is an additional glory. So if you want to, if Sri Krishna is going to say among the Vedas, I am the best, I am the most glorious one, the Veda that is most glorious to listen to, because it has this full melody. So that's the metaphor. Devanam, among the gods, asmi, I am Vasava. And my this translation is wrong. I'm the Vasu's. Vasu can become Vasava. That's incorrect. When I prepare these translations, I'm sorry to say I do it fairly quickly, because it's kind of a tedious task to sit at my computer and type in all these translations. So I tend to go through very quickly. When I prepare for class, however, I read Shankara's commentary. So here, Vasava is one of the many names for Indra. Has no reference to, there's a group of gods called Vasus, and there's no connection here at all. So here, Vasava is one of the names for Indra. Indra, as you all know, is king of the gods, the mightiest of the gods. So if Sri Krishna is going to say, among the gods, I am the best, then he's definitely going to say, among the gods, I am Indra. Indriyanam, among the senses. What are your senses? Sight, hearing, taste, touch, and smell. These are your senses. But there's one more. There's actually, in Vedic terminology, they speak of a sixth sense. By the way, sixth sense in Vedic terminology doesn't mean some kind of ESP. They didn't. I don't. They didn't believe in all of that stuff. ESP and all of this. They didn't believe. But they did understand there was another karana. The word karana means sense organ. So these five karanas, these five sense organs, are well known to us. But there's a sixth, which is inner, reference to all of them. Notice your eyes are on the outside, ears are on the outside, skin is on the outside. But there's one karana, one organ, which is antaha. What is that one? Antaha karana. Antahkarana is one of the common words for mind. So the mind is considered one of the senses, and the mind is the foremost because the other five are known because of the mind. So therefore, Sri Krishna would definitely say, among the karanas, among the indriyas, among the sense organs, manaha cha asmi, I am manas, I am the mind. And finally, bhutanam, for all beings, and here it suggests living beings, for all beings, aham asmi, I am chetana. Chetana here means consciousness, but not consciousness in the sense of Satchidananda. More consciousness, more in a medical meaning, that someone is alive, someone is responding to the world around them. Sri Shankara says that chetana is buddhivrittihi, activities of the intellect, activities of the mind. So for all beings, Sri Krishna says, I am that activity of the mind. What is it that makes a conscious being most conscious, most awareful? Theoretically, plants are living beings. Do you ever wonder what plants think about? Of course you don't think about what plants think about, because plants don't think. They don't have a brain, they don't have a mind. How about cockroaches? Cockroaches have a brain. They do. What do they think about? Their brains are not sophisticated enough for thoughts as we understand. So then you go up the ladder. What do dogs think about? They think, not in words. We think a lot in words. Dogs think like food, food, food. Or the dog needs to go outside, outside, outside. They have some kind of rudimentary kind of thinking. I'm sure they do. But what would be the highest expression of consciousness would be the activities of our intellects. That's what Shankara says. Buddhi vrittihi, the highest expression of sentiency is the activity of intellect. And that's referred here as chetana. So Sri Krishna says, I am that. I am that. Bhutanam, for all living beings, I am that which causes that activity of the intellect, that intellectual activity. Once again, this is meant for meditation. It's not meant for study. We've already understood based on chapter 7 and 9. So how to meditate? Well, you know, devanam asmi indra, maybe not meditate. Maybe I meditate on Indra, but again, that ancient culture is something we may not relate to so directly. But you can certainly meditate, contemplate, reflect on the glories of Ishvara, which are right here. What a miracle that our minds think. It is a miracle, isn't it? Can you imagine? And you all know this from the standpoint of science, that our brains are complicated webs of billions and trillions of neurons, just like a complicated computer, not unlike a complicated computer. Well, every computer that exists requires a lot of programming. Here, we have something that thinks on its own. It was created to think on its own. Our minds and our intellects are an absolute miracle of creation. And to reflect on that with a quiet, contemplative mind is what this verse is telling us to do. To appreciate in meditation that your ability to think, to conceive, to feel, to have thoughts, that ability is one of God's many, many, many glories. In fact, it seems to me that any consideration of a human being just leads you to reflect more and more on God's glories. Think about the perspective of a scientist or a medical doctor. A scientist understanding the complexity of the universe and layer after layer of complexity, and how the laws of the universe are just right. Very interesting. There's in science, there are certain basic parameters, like the gravitational constant. Gravitational constant determines how hard the Earth pulls you down. If the gravitational constant were stronger, you'd get pulled down to the Earth much more strongly, which means you would weigh more. If the gravitational constant were weaker, you'd be pulled down less strongly to the Earth, which means you would weigh less. Now, it turns out that the fact that the gravitational constant is exactly what it is crucial, because it determines the distance from the sun that the Earth travels. If the gravitational constant were stronger, the Earth would circle the sun more closely. We'd all be burnt to a crisp. In fact, there would never be any life on this planet. It would never have begun. If the gravitational constant were weaker, the Earth would circle much farther away from the sun. This planet would be an ice cube. But the gravitational constant is just right. And like this, there are, I think, seven or more. I don't remember the exact number. There are a small number of fundamental constants in nature. And because those parameters are what they are, the universe exists as it is. If those parameters were off, not only would this Earth not exist as an inhabitable planet, but if some of those parameters were off, there would be no universe. There would be no stars, no planets, no galaxies. There'd be nothing, honestly. So this is how a scientist might appreciate God's glories. In fact, allow me just to elaborate. If a scientist were writing this passage, thank goodness a scientist is not, but a scientist might write something like, among the forces in nature. So the scientist will speak of four forces of nature. The gravity is one of these four fundamental forces of nature. But the scientist would say, of the four forces of nature, I am the nuclear strong force. Now, that's probably not a familiar term to many of you. A scientist would recognize that the nuclear strong force is the strongest of the four forces of nature. By the way, the nuclear strong force is a force because of which the sun is able to burn hydrogen into helium. It creates heat. Nuclear fission is actually a different force. Actually, I think strong force is also there. Yes, strong force is there. So the nuclear fission, atomic bombs and nuclear reactors also work because of this strong force. The point I'm making is if we were to put this in modern terms, we could appreciate the glories of God in so many places, in nature, and finally, in the human body. What a unimaginable glory it is, the complexity of our bodies, the complexity of the heart and the circulatory system, the complexity of the brain and the nervous system. Every aspect of our body is complicated and so well designed. It's just absolutely a miracle of nature. Now you may argue, oh Swamiji, it's not, no one designed it, it evolved that way. Of course, I'm not dumb. You know, it's not like God decided, oh, let me design a human body. Let me put the head on top. I think it would be a good idea to put the head on the top and the feet. Come on. Yes, the body, yes, human beings evolve like that. How is evolution so powerful? to lead to this incredible creation. So that principle of evolution, that nature supports evolution, is a glory of God. You're with me. Okay, enough. All of this is meant for meditation. Let us continue. Rudranham Shankarashchasmi, Rudranham Shankara Viddesho Yaksha Rakshasam, Viddesho Rakshayak Vasunham Pavakashchasmi, Vasunham Pavakash Meru Shikarinamaham, Meru Shikarinam. Rudranam, among the Rudras, another class of gods, not just one Rudra, a bunch of them. 12 Adityas, 49 Maruts, 11 Rudras. So you go through the Puranas and you can find all of this information and find their names. So among the Rudras, Shankaraha Asmi, I am Shankara. One of the many names for Lord Shiva. Among the Rudras, I am the best. Who is the best Rudra? Shankara. Viteshaha Yaksha Rakshasam. Among the Yakshas and Rakshas. Yaksha is a class of celestial being. Raksha is actually a word for Rakshasa, another kind of celestial being. So among these yakshas and rakshasas, I am Vittesha. I am the Isha of Vitta. I am the god of wealth. The god of wealth, Kubera in the mythology, Kubera. Among all of these deities, yakshas and rakshas, I am Kubera. I am the lord of wealth. Vasunam, among the Vasus. I made reference to that before. How many Vasus? 8. Again, you go through the mythology and you get to find who are the 8 Vasus. Among all the Vasus, the best of them, the most powerful of them, the most glorious of them is Pavakaha. Pavakaha asmi. Pavaka is a name for fire. Literally means that which purifies, and it's one of our many words for fire. So among the Vasus, I am Pavaka, I am fire, and Shikarinam, among mountains, literally means that which has a peak. Among mountains, aham, I am Meruhu. Meru is noted here, not that it's tallest of the mountain. Meru is considered a mountain that forms the axis on which the earth spins. Now again, this is, you know, in ancient times they didn't understand the north and south poles and the tilt of the axis. A lot of those details was not well understood. So in the mythology then, they did know that the earth was turning. By the way, interesting that the ancient rishis never made the mistake of thinking that the earth was flat. They never made the mistake of thinking that the sun went around the earth. They never made those mistakes. They always had that part right. They knew the earth turned. If the earth turns, it's turning on an axis. What is the axis? Meru. So that mountain, that Meru, is the axis on which the earth turns. Again, all of this is meant for meditation. To meditate on God's glory as the axis on which the earth turns, to meditate on God's glory in a form of fire. All of this was intended by this verse. Then, Purodhasam cha mukhyam mam, Purodhasam cha mukhyam, Vidhi partha brihaspatim, Senani namaham skandaha, Senani namaham skand, Sarasamasmi sagaraha, Sarasamasmi sagaraha. Purodhasam, Purodhas is priest. So who is the foremost, Purodhasam, the foremost among all the priests? Who is the Mukhyam? Sri Krishna says, Mam, I am. Vidhi Mam, Partha, O Arjuna, know that I, know that the mukhyam, the best of the priests, the foremost of the priests is whom? Brihaspati. And that Brihaspati, I am. Brihaspati, by the way, is the priest of the gods. So gods have their own king, Indra. Gods have their own, pardon me for being silly, gods have their own financial consultant and banker, Kubera, that Vitesha god of wealth. So the gods should have their own priest. The gods should have their own guru. So the priest of the gods or the guru of the gods is Brihaspati. So Sri Krishna here says, among all priests, I am the mukhyam, I am the foremost, I am Brihaspati, Vidhi Partha Mam. Understand me to be that Brihaspati, the one who is the god, the priest to the gods. Senani Nam, among all warriors, Aham Skandaha. So if the gods are organizing a war, who is going to be the foremost warrior, who is going to be in charge of the army? Skanda, one of Shiva's sons in the mythology, he is the mighty warrior. He holds that veil, that weapon. So Skanda is the foremost among all warriors. So Sri Krishna says, Aham Skandaha, I am Skanda among all warriors. Sarasamasmi Sagaraha, among all bodies of water, Sarasam. You have different lakes, different rivers, different bodies of water, but the vastest body of water, of course, is the ocean, the sea, Sagara. So, among all bodies of water, I am the sea. Again, this is meant for meditation. Many of you have already done this. Have you ever sat on the shore of the sea and just stare out into that ocean, and the waves are coming in? And what's significant about it is you don't see anything on the horizon. It just goes on and on and on and on. To meditate on the sea in that way is what's meant here. And isn't it interesting that even a non-religious person can sit down and look at the sea and have what we would call a religious experience? Because you sense that vastness of the sea, and that vastness indeed is a glory of God. Let us see just one more verse. Maharshinam bhrguraham, maharshinam bhrguraham. Giram hasmyekam aksharam, giram hasmyekam aksharam. Yajnanam japa yajnyosmi, yajnanam japa yajnyosmi. Stavaranam himalayah, stavaranam himalayah. Actually, there's more I would like to say about this verse, so we'll save this verse for our next class. Just return to that last thought. How these meditations work, and how simple it is. You've already done this. You have looked up in the night sky, and you have felt God's vastness. You have felt the warmth of the sun, and you have felt God's blessings. If you've ever gone high up in the mountains, you've looked across the countryside, and again, you've sensed God's vastness. And as we just said, you've looked out across the ocean, and you sense God's vastness. All of this is a meditation. It's seeing the vastness, seeing the glories, seeing the extremes of God's presence here in this universe, as that upadana and nimitta karana, as the source of the material because of which the universe exists, as the source of the intelligence because of which the universe exists. All of this is meant for meditation. And we've seen the opening portion of these meditations, and they'll continue in the next class. All right. A couple of important announcements. Tomorrow we have our class for teenagers at 11 a.m. We have our usual satsang. If you have any questions, I'll be conducting satsang at 6 p.m. Last Sunday, we intended to have our first mindful awareness meditation session, and I felt very bad that we had to cancel it. Our parking lot was full of ice, and I was very concerned that no one should be injured, so we had to cancel it. Also, I have to apologize because we sent out the email announcement, and when I made the phone message, I pushed the wrong button, and my recording wasn't recorded. So I know at least one or two people were inconvenienced by that. I'll do my best to do both. When we cancel a class, we'll send the email out. We'll also record a message on that option 4. Anyway, if the weather permits, and I think the weather is... What a difference! By the way, some of you come for our Tuesday class. It was like 5 degrees when you came for Tuesday class. Today, it's 60. What crazy weather. Anyway, so assuming that we don't get another foot of snow or inch of ice tomorrow, which is not likely, so tomorrow will be the first of our mindful awareness meditations. I mentioned that this is a very important form of meditation that we do only occasionally on Saturdays. We want to do it every week. So every Sunday at 5 p.m., the session on mindful awareness meditation will be conducted. I'm very happy that Vasanti will be conducting these sessions. And that session, if you like to stay back, will be followed by my satsang. So please join us 5 p.m. for the meditation session. A request. I need to get a visa. And we all know that dealing with the embassy and their visa organization, it's a headache. And I'm trying to get the application. There's a problem with the application. Here's a request. If any of you work in the city or go to the city regularly, if you would be able to take my stack of papers and go to the visa office, which is in Midtown, I think something 37th and Madison. I don't know the town. But if any of you would be able to help me in that way, I'll give you the stack of papers. You can go there and talk to them in person and hopefully figure things out and get the visa organized. If you're able to do that, I would be extremely grateful. So see if you can. Library will be open after class, and we'll conclude with our prayers.